All right, this is David Colburn. Today is Wednesday, March the 24th, and I'm with Bruce Rogers. We're doing the second part of our interview, and we hope to finish it this morning. We are in Bruce Rogers' home conducting this interview at present. Bruce, we stopped with a discussion of you getting back to England after you've been shot down over France, and you and your crew made it back. Two of the men had been injured and got about a month off, while the rest of you started right back flying over Europe. Do you remember how many more missions you had after you were shot down? I guess that you were shot down, if I remember correctly, in
November.
November. Of 44, so you had still quite a stint in front of you, didn't you?
Well, yeah, we were down there for 9 days. It was over what would have been Thanksgiving, and I had a birthday in there. I had a birthday. I was 20 years old. And we were there 9 days, so I think it was like the first week in December, before Christmas anyway. We got back for Christmas to the UK. And my two ace gunners who had been wounded got a month off. They had medical leave, and then they were given passes. Where they went, I don't know, but they were told to be back on a certain date, and I forget what that date was, but they had a full 2 weeks off. And we did too, but that was a combination of bad flying weather, and number two, because they weren't going to hold us up from flying because two waste gunners weren't with us. They would assign two more waste gunners to us. That wasn't a problem, but the weather was bad.
Where did you concentrate in that winter where they had the Battle of the Bulge and they had a stalemate? Mm-hmm. Where did you concentrate the bombing? Was it over Belgium and Germany?
No, not Belgium. I don't remember hitting Belgium. I remember hitting, the two biggest raids were actually in February of 45. To Berlin. These were 1,000 plane raids. And of course, the weather fortunately had cleared up, and that permitted them to schedule that. I think the effort there was to discourage and help the German people put pressure on calling for a ceasefire and a surrender.
You had commented a couple of times that a 1,000 bomber raid was quite extraordinary. What was the normal number of bombers involved in a mission, or roughly normal?
They would probably number 300.
300, so a third.
I mean, I'm guessing a little here, but it depended on the number. Well, it depended on the target, what do they want to hit, and how many airplanes were ready. that was a factor. Where I was in Stad, I was not in the command group that was, neither selecting the targets nor deciding whether to go or not go, but usually you found out at the time the mission who was going. Usually they were the same groups, all from East Anglia, and if they called for maximum effort, of course that was really a 1,000 plane raid.
So the Americans, just restate this, the Americans went out during the day.
Yes.
And the British went out at night.
They went out at night. Mm-hmm. Yep, they seldom. Well, they tried the daytime bombing, and their casualty rates were so high, the British people just wouldn't tolerate it. So they switched to nighttime bombing. And they said, you Americans are... you're stupid. You're going out in the daytime. Well, it was quite interesting as our... After D-Day, and we moved, and our troops were moving the Germans back from the coast further to the west, taking the German fighters back. Two things happened. One, the intensity of the anti-aircraft came up tremendously. I mean, the fighters started disappearing, but the Germans brought in their 88s on railroad cars and put their emplacements in around strategic targets, and it became intense. You could see that. As a matter of fact, looking back at it, it became quite apparent. And this, as you moved in, the fighters, of course, our fighters too had something to do with it. They were keeping them from harassing us, but the intensity of the flak increased tremendously. Even in small areas that you wouldn't think you would experience flak.
When, from say February 45 on till the end of the war in Europe, your missions must have been intense. I mean, you must have been flying most days of the week when the weather permitted.
When the weather was good, I flew probably 6 missions out of 10 days, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And how did you all hold up psychologically with all of this, with the intensity of the 88 fire, flak fire, having been shot down once already? How did you keep your morale and up?
Our morale was very high. Fortunately, being at the age we were, some of these things didn't bother us quite as acutely as some of the older guys. I had a navigator in my group who was married. He didn't have children, but he was married. He wanted to go home, and he had, I think, 2 more missions to go. He had flown 28. He had 2 more to go to get 30 to go home, and he was sent to a flak home. I mean, he just couldn't stand it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the anxiety of completing 2 more missions and then going home, and the fact that he had been through probably a good number of the really heaviest flak targets that we had at Frankfurt and Augsburg, and he just, and they grounded him and they sent him down to Oxford to the flak, we call them flak homes.
The flak home was just to get some rest,
right?
Get some psychological counseling,
get their mind off of flak and any other duty aspects. It worked to a degree.
Did you see him again, or was that...
Or
did he go home?
Know, I did see him again. He came back and then went home.
Okay.
He went home because the war was ending. And he came back. He flew. Yeah, he flew with us to some of our food dropping missions in the lowlands. I know. And then went home. Those were fairly easy. We were shot at a little bit, but there was a German pocket of resistance there right up, matter of fact, to the first week in May in 45.
Literally to the end of the war.
Yeah, they had cut off the Dutch population, the Netherlands people, from even trains coming in with medical supplies, emergency supplies. They were starving. They needed food of any kind, so when the word went out, they said And they negotiated with the German commander of that particular, I don't know whether it was a battalion or whatever, to humanitarian reasons that he would cease firing on us if we went in and dropped food. Well, they did not hold to their agreement because we got shot at. And we're at 300 feet. We're good targets.
Yeah, you're very low, so that I guess when the food hit, it wouldn't, you could get it pretty much concentrated where you wanted the food to be.
We, of course, were dropping bulk supplies. We didn't have any, like today, they have all kinds of containers and stuff that they send out with parachutes on them. We just loaded in the bomb bay, opened the bomb bay, and dropped out bags of flour.
Parachutes on.
No parachutes, nothing. So that would hit the ground, they were desperate. And it's interesting. I had a guy working for me down here, Fritz Benzer, who was there at the time receiving this food. He's over here. He's still here. He's a cripple today. He's a wood carving expert. But we became acquainted over here when he found out the time I was over there. He said, I remember, because he was in Amsterdam. And he said, literally, we were eating tulip bulbs. So we had nothing. We were stopped.
What was his name again?
Fritz. His last name was Benkin.
Okay.
Yeah. His address, he is very active in a wood carving group here. They meet over at the park over here in the administration building. They have a place set up where alternate Thursdays they go over and he makes, this is strictly for his own
pleasure,
figures. War mementos, he carves little airplanes, trains, and all that sort of stuff. And he was very handy. He was one of our actual draftsmen in the engineering department. Very meticulous.
Well, that's an interesting story for the two of you to meet up.
I never met any of his family. He had no real relatives here. And I think I've had conversations with him as how he got back over here after the war. And I don't recall those details.
Now, did you ever get hit again? Did your plane ever get hit again in the subsequent missions?
Not so that we lost our position in the formations, no.
Okay.
Knock on wood. They tried.
I tried. And the biggest missions... What were the most strategic missions you were involved in after February of 45, between February and May?
Oh, well, I think one of the strategic ones was a rather uneventful mission. But anyway, we were after stopping supplying Mr. Hitler's eagle's nest at Berchtesgaden. We went into the marshalling yards in Linz, Austria, because they thought he was getting supplied by rail and trucks and whatever. So we went in there to knock out the rail lines, which we did in Linz. That was a major rail connecting area east and west. And it turned out that Mr. Hitler wasn't in Berchtesgaden anyway. He was in Berlin. That's where they...
Were you involved in the bombing of Dresden?
We hit Dresden, yes. We hit Dresden. We hit Kiel area. We hit Frankfurt. We hit Augsburg. We hit several smaller areas in my time over there for knocking out the Focke-Wulf plant. We hit Schweinfurt again, where they were still managing to make ball bearings. Sometimes we didn't know. We knew what the target was on the day that the targets were assigned, but we sometimes didn't have a full grasp of how significant the strategy was to wound the German army. But we figured knocking out their fighter aircraft was important, and it was. And obviously their fuel lines supplying the tanks and
where did you bomb where they kept their fuel storage areas? Where were they? Were they up north?
Well, most of them, yeah, we're on the north side. Yeah. I can't remember any given raid, my time anyway. I mean, prior to me is when they hit Polesti to knock out the Romanian oil fields mm-hmm. that were supplying huge amounts of oil for the tanks.
Now you wouldn't have bombed there in Romania. They would have bombed the bombers. American bombers from Italy would have.
No, our group.
Your group
we
did.
We got a presidential citation for bombing Polesti.
Really?
And they went to the UK. They went to Africa. And then flew to the Polesti oil fields, and then they went to the Ukraine to refuel, and then came back.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere I have a write-up on the number of planes that our group sent in there, but about half of them got back.
I was going to say you couldn't fly round trip.
No, no.
You had to come down in the Ukraine or someplace to refuel, didn't you?
Yeah. See, we had 2,700 gallons of fuel, and we burned about 400 gallons an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, at 40,000 feet, you leaned it out. We could get there, but you couldn't never get back.
Mm-hmm.
That was a limit. About 800 miles in and 800 back out, and that was it.
Now, were you ever given targets where it was to help the Russian advance as they advanced against the Germans from the east?
Probably, but we didn't know that.
Okay.
We didn't know that. We were... Generally, it became self-evident when they assigned what the target was. You knew if you're going to hit the Focke-Wulf plant in Augsburg or any of the tooling industry that was supplying tools and stuff or munitions areas, you knew that.
Mm-hmm.
The why and wherefore of it sometimes wasn't apparent to us.
Did you bomb Poland?
No.
You didn't bomb Poland?
We did not bomb Poland.
And did you?
Our group, anyway.
Were you, pilots have any knowledge of the concentration camps? And were you ever given any missions relative to the concentration camps?
Not till afterwards.
So you didn't know about the concentration camps until the war was over?
Well, till the 5th day of May, when I went. That actually the war peace was being signed that day. We went to Munich, and we're one of the first groups into Munich and went to see Dachau.
Okay.
And that's the first we were aware.
And when you got to...
We became acutely aware after that.
Yeah. Did you actually, was there anybody at Dachau when you got there? Was there...
Oh, yeah.
So there were still Jews and...
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, where did you land? Did you land at a Munich airfield?
At the Munich airfield. Yep. Okay. It was...
And now, why did you happen...
We got shot at there, as a matter of fact. We got out and we... their method of maintaining their airfield over there was by... Their lawnmowers and grass cutters were sheep and cattle, which were run by shepherds that were, and this shepherd guy came out as we're getting out of the airplane. He was begging for food. And about the time he got there, on the hard stand where my airplane was, and we were out of the airplane, we got fired on by snipers. We thought that area had been cleared, you know. So somewhere out there, they didn't like us.
Now, how did you happen to be going to Munich and choose to go to Dachau?
Why we went to Munich, I can't recall. The shooting war was over. We weren't on a bombing mission. We weren't, to the best of my recollection, we weren't carrying anything they needed there. I honestly don't recall.
And why did you choose to go out to Dachau?
We stumbled on that quite by accident. We were going to be there one or 2 days. And we had to find our own place to bivouac. And we did commandeer a Jeep and a weapons carrier so we could do some sightseeing around. Matter of fact, that same day, that's quite amazing, is the day the Germans put their electrified streetcar back on the tracks. They're running and there's a big celebration. This is, something they hadn't been able to do for quite some time. And they had a power generator was giving them enough. It was DC, I'm pretty sure, running that streetcar on the rails. They put it on the rail. One car, but it was a big celebration. I remember there, like a Mardi Gras. hard to believe.
So you went out to Dachau and
we were escorted out there. Yeah,
really?
They said, you got to see this. So we were taken out. They wanted us to see it. Our people wanted us to see it.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
It must have been appalling.
It was appalling, yeah. But once, at that point, it became aware that because by then they had stumbled on Auschwitz and two or three others, and of course had newsreel pictures of this, which when we got back to the UK, we saw. Mm-hmm. We said, by golly, yes. It was appalling.
Tell me about what did Munich look like?
Oh, it was a shambles. Yeah, it was pretty much a shambles.
Any buildings standing or?
Well, there were buildings standing, but there was an awful lot of them that were nothing but rubble in the street. Of course, as you know, that's what they went and shoveled it all up and made a place for the Olympics, an Olympic stadium over there, out of all of the rubble and the ground down buildings. The major parts of town were they were, storefronts were gone, glass was gone, buildings were in a horrible state of repair. The Germans are really funny. They were very industrious, though. They were cleaning up while we were there. Going to put it back in shape.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
They were...
Get on with their lives.
They needed everything, though. I mean, they were really... We had done a pretty good job.
What was the... was there any strategy, bombing strategy, relative to the POW camps, were you guys cautioned about?
Yes, we knew where these camps were. If they were going to be near our target area, they pointed out where these were. They're pretty hard to see from 25,000 feet.
I would imagine.
But So all you could do is know that if you were not dropping your bombs on the target per se, and you were just, and you had a problem, don't drop your bombs over where the anticipated POW camps were.
Were you briefed? I know reading stories of the prisoner of war experience for those who had been pilots and navigators and so forth, as well as ground troops, that they were marched out. They were kept in the east in part of Germany, and then they were marched to the west mm-hmm. as the Russians advanced. Did you have to, you must have had to be careful about who you bombed on the road, especially toward the toward May of 45 as they were marching the POWs.
Well, most times those were not strategic air targets at all.
Okay.
We were, I would assume our B-25s and A-20s that were doing low-level bombing and stuff would have to do that. They were on interdiction missions, and we were strictly, we had a limited target area, and we were cautioned about where to drop bombs. If you missed your primary and secondary targets, you know, don't drop it on, drop it in the spot where it's not going to hurt our own troops mm-hmm. if we knew where they were. In most cases, we pretty much knew where our forces were.
Did you drop your bomb load over the North Sea, or did you drop it in Germany or someplace?
We usually dropped it in Germany.
Okay. Yeah.
If we had to leave the formation because we were losing an engine or we had some other mechanical problems, we would drop our bomb load to get rid of the weight as quickly as possible. I only had that one occasion when I went down where, but we had already dropped our bombs on the target. But I had an occasion where a bomb hung up where we left it in the hang up position until we got back over the channel. And then we had to go in there and trip it out. But in most cases, you dropped it somewhere where it wasn't going to harm our troops. Mm-hmm. Hopefully do some German damage.
So you only had one experience where the bomb hung up.
It hung up, yeah. And we couldn't. So we said, well, we'll leave it hung up until we get back over the channel, and then we're going to get rid of it because I'm not going to land with it in my bomb bay.
Yeah, that would be.
It was a 1,000-pound bomb.
Yeah, that would be a bit nerve-wracking to try and land with it.
Yeah, so we had to get, my Tagalier got in there, and he actually tripped it out with a screwdriver and a pair of pliers on the bomb rack and dropped that thing out. So.
What about as the months went by between March and April, when did you have a real sense that this war was just about over in Europe?
We felt probably after the second raid on Berlin in February, I think we felt this thing is dying down, that our target selection, and we got, of course, at that time, we're getting pretty good news data that was coming back to us. We were probably on the next day after, say, the Battle of the Bulge deal went on, we knew what had happened there and what was going on. And you could pretty much tell.
Mm-hmm.
Although in April, we were surprised that we were going to go in as far as Linz, Austria, knowing that this thing was coming to an end. We didn't feel comfortable bombing their cities or the population anymore. It had to be a real strategic type mission. You know, somebody said, okay, the marshaling yards are at Linz. That's supplying by rail an area that they're supplying for Mr. Hitler. We need to knock that out. Okay, go.
When you went into Romania, and then you refueled in the Ukraine, at that point you were really behind Russian lines, weren't you? Because the Russians had, by that point, probably advanced through the Ukraine.
That's right. They had come across Romania. When they went into Polotsk, though, because you're looking at it before my time, and that the first Polotsk raids were in 1943. And again, I think the second time was maybe in late 43. And then those oil fields were damaged by the Russian forces, if my recollection serves me.
Okay.
They got them. We were back over there just about a year or so ago. I went up there to the Russian, to the Polesti oil fields. And they're in full swing again. They're going full bore, and you could not see any evidence of what had occurred. So
the war years were a distant memory.
Yeah. The Russian or the Romanians themselves are typically a third world country. There wasn't any great progression in there, but those oil fields were going full steam.
Where were you when the war ended in Europe?
I was, when the war in Europe ended, I was in the UK.
And what was the celebration like?
Oh, it was a pretty good celebration. I'll tell you. When the peace was declared, everybody celebrated. I'll tell you, there was one guy that really was unhappy with us, though, and I was the farmer who owned our land that Snutterton Heath was on. It was a farmer, he was farming there yet while it was an active air base, and he had a huge haystack out there to feed his cattle. And our guys got really celebrating. They went over there and they set his hay pile on fire. It went up. And he was not happy. Man, he came storming over, and our colonel was very embarrassed. But the colonel was celebrating along with everybody else, so we had to pay him for that. We had negotiated a deal, though, to take care of him. And he says, well, that you can give me a whole pile of American dollars, and that's not going to feed my cattle. He says, I don't have any hay. He was serious. But yes, that night, the celebrating went on all night until the wee hours. I mean, it was a happy group.
Now, you didn't go home right away, though. You stayed there.
That's right. We got picked and were put into an OSS project called Casey Jones. And we were reassigned to the 306th Bomb Group. This was like in end of August, early September. Japanese war was still going. And we were ready.
Okay, so that must have been late July, very early August, because the war in Japan will end
in August.
August 9th.
Right.
With the second atomic bomb.
This was in July. We were still thinking they're going to send us back home to train on B-29s to carry on in the Japanese conflict. And we fully expected when our number got called that that's what they're going to tell us. And instead they said, no, we're going over to Huntington, which was the base we got transferred to. And they told us we're going to be assigned to the OSS, who's going to control what you're doing, even though you're still going to be assigned to the 8th Air Force, who was under their jurisdiction. They sent us to Gibraltar. and we started mapping the Iberian Peninsula. And from there, when we got that done, they sent us over to Port Leoti in Africa. And we were doing high altitude photo from Cairo all the way around to Dakar. Probably 5 or 6 miles in from the coast all the way around, because the aerial maps were terrible. And of course, all of that sort of work that we were doing with the satellites, it was futile. We wasted a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort.
What was the purpose of all of that?
To improve the navigational maps, I think, for
the U.S. as well as for Europe, I guess.
As well as for the military, yeah, mm-hmm. and as well as for all our allies. And they were making, we did, probably three-mile wide strips in layers all the way across Spain from east to west. And then we did Africa from Cairo all the way around to Dakar.
And you did that all the way up till when?
Until we came home.
And you came home?
In 46. I got back home in this country the end of July of 1946.
So over a
year. I had a 30-day leave after that, so I got out of the active service in the third week, about third week in August of 1946.
Yeah. And then you did what after you?
Too late to get into any university right then.
Right.
That was kind of discouraging. I had my heart set on doing that. And I thought, oh, here it is, the end of August, school starts. Michigan, I couldn't get in time. So I went to school at a tech school in Detroit that was operating. I went and checked out the credit transferability between that school and Michigan where I wanted to go. And they were all transferable. So I stayed there for the fall semester and then transferred to Ann Arbor.
And after you came out of, what did you major in Ann Arbor?
Engineering. I had a Bachelor of Science in Engineering, and then I stayed and got my Master's in Business, which took to 1952.
And did the GI Bill cover your expenses?
Covered the whole thing. Yeah, we got $75 a month, I think. They picked up the tuition and they picked up our books within whatever their allowable range was. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very adequate. Didn't give you much in the way of living expenses, but gave you some. Mm-hmm. Paid for your laundry, I thought that was a good deal.
And you finished, and then where did you go?
Back to Detroit. Yeah.
And you
working for a job.
And what did you do?
Went to work for Massey Ferguson, who was at that time Harry Ferguson. Harry Ferguson was a interesting engineer, an Irishman. Engineer developed a patented hydraulic device to control ground implements on farm equipment. And they were working in a joint agreement with Ford Motor Car Company, who was selling the tractors. Their marketing and distribution network sold the Ferguson tractors. Well, it became Ford Ferguson, actually, was the name of the tractors. You may have heard of them. I don't know.
Yes.
But along about, I had been there 6 months. And Harry Ferguson sued Ford for patent infringement because he was using the Ferguson-developed hydraulic device under the Ford name. And I forget what the total amount of the suit was. It was a major amount of multi-million dollar suit. We got $9 million. At that time, there was a split between Ford and Ferguson, and he became, Harry Ferguson became Ferguson. He dropped the Ford part of that. But I went to work for them.
And you worked for them how many years?
Oh, I only worked for them maybe less than 2 years. I have to stop and think. 52, was it a year? It was more than a year, but less than 2 years. It's closer to 2 years, I think. I was, it was a economic period, much like we have right now, for jobs. The farm industry was going down, the sales dropped off, and they were laying off people. At the same time, they were building, and did build, a completely automated tractor assembly plant over on Southfield Road. I mean, this was really a state of the art. And breaking away from Ford, because they were going to build their own tractors and still buy our engines from Ford. They still used a Ford engine in them. But when they started laying off, I had, at that point in time, I had made a decision to get married, and I couldn't afford to be without a job, and I couldn't afford to be laid off, and so I started reactivating irons in the wind for another job, and which I got, and joined a firm in the gear business with a family-owned business who's one of his daughters was my wife's sorority sister, and very highly specialized business, which was good training ground for engineers and also business.
And you made gears for all sorts of...
Everything, from airplanes to transmissions for boats to... we made the transmissions for the unlimited hydroplanes that were racing on the Detroit River and other places for people like Gale Electric.
And, like Erie and such.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We made the propeller shafts for the Goodyear blimps, where it's not the way they're designed today, but at that point in time, the engines were hung outside the rigid frame of the dirigible, and they had to have an expanse between the engine and the props, about a 6.5 foot length of serrated drive shaft, if it's the right word. And we developed a way to spline those things for them that no one else could figure out how to do. It turned out to be a very simple way. So we did jet engine parts for Pratt Whitney. Not all types of gearing. We didn't do the kinds of gears you used in rear axles, hydrofoil type gears. We didn't generate those.
And you were with them for how long?
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah.
And you got married at this point.
I was married.
And you married a woman from... Was she from Detroit?
Yeah, she was from Grosse Pointe.
And her name was?
Catherine Ann Cowan. Her dad was a doctor there.
And how did you two meet?
She actually was a neighbor of mine, but I didn't know it. But she had a date with one of my fraternity brothers at my fraternity house. And we got acquainted there. Mm-hmm. And then she was ahead of me. She graduated in, '48. And she was in, went into med school, and I, of course, was and when she graduated, she didn't stay. She decided she didn't like med school. She went back home. And I forget how we finally got reacquainted. It was after graduation. Mm-hmm. I came back and we picked it up.
Now, did you two have children?
Yeah.
How many children?
Four children.
Four children?
Three girls and a son.
And where are they now?
Well, I lost my youngest daughter. She passed away about 5 years ago. My oldest daughter is in Orlando. She's a freelance writer. And my second oldest daughter is in Roswell, Georgia. She has two children. My young son is in the CIA, and he is at the present time at Bagram in Afghanistan. I talk to him on our Skype radio here about once a week. He was sent over to replace one of those 11 that were killed here just about, what?
Two months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's got five more weeks to go. He gets back here on the 8th of May.
How long's he been in the service?
Oh, he's been in the CIA ever since he got out of school. Okay. Well, that's not quite true. He went in the Air Force. He wanted to be a pilot. And they found an eye defect in the early flight stages and said, we would love to keep you in, but it'll be in a non-flying status. And he chose to leave. And then he went into the, after all the investigative work they did, he finally got in the CIA. His wife was also in the CIA. And she was, her dad was right under the top guy in the CIA. He was the human resource person. And she worked for, and she was running the Situation Room in the White House for a number of years until she ran afoul of a guy by the name of Scowcroft. And they didn't hit it off, and she asked to get out, and believe it or not, they let her retire. She's retired from the CIA. I couldn't believe it. But my son, when they got married, that's the only job he's ever had. Mm.
Tell me, were you ever facing the possibility of being reactivated for the Korean War?
Definitely, yeah. That's the chance. At that point in time, there was actually a slim chance, though, for our military occupational specialty and equipment that we were trained to fly on was not what they were looking for.
And not in use anymore, really. The B-19 wasn't flying anymore.
It was not flying anymore. The 29 was phasing out from its original design. They were looking for people to become jet pilots for the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for Navy guys. So I didn't feel that I was really going to get activated. I was not. Well, there was quite a few guys. Most of the ones that went in that were in were people who chose to go back in. Mm-hmm. On their own volition. They weren't activated or certainly drafted. They chose to get back in, either because they liked the military life or they were not happy with their civilian occupation or whatever.
Had your unit started having reunions at all at this point?
The 8th Air Force did, but my particular bomb group, I never never got any kind of an announcement or any search group or anything that I can recall trying to reactivate union-wise, but the 8th Air Force did. So they have one every year.
Do you go to the 8th Air Force?
No, I got into one and was instrumental in helping them put together the 8th Air Force Museum in near Savannah.
Savannah, right.
Yeah.
Just
because it was in close proximity. But I was never a big, what I call reunion candidate. That didn't really appeal to me.
Mm-hmm.
If my own squadron or my own bomb group had something that was in, I would have been very happy to reignite any only lost, but such never occurred. I never recalled really getting any kind of an announcement. 8th Air Force did. They sent notices out.
And how about your squadron? Did you stay in touch with the fellows that flew with you?
The only ones that I stayed in touch with were ones that were geographically located where I was.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of them. I met with part of my group not too long after we all got home, after maybe one semester of college. My co-pilot came down. He was going to school in Illinois. Was taking a cross-country trip to see hadn't seen our part of the country, Detroit area. He came down to visit. And that was about the last. So, part of that, I guess, is partly my fault because I could go in very easily and track some of these guys down, but they're pretty widely scattered from California.
You all sort of got on with living your lives, didn't you?
That's right. They could easily have contacted me, too, and let me track them, but such has never occurred. So they must, hopefully, all doing well.
To go back to your life back in the States, again, you were with the gear company for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do after that?
The gear company was sold. We had to sell our interest in it. Was sold to Accelo Corporation, if you remember who they were.
Mm-hmm.
They went and became part of the Michigan gear division of Accelo. I took a job with the corporate office of American Standard in New York. And strangely enough, my boss, who was my boss at Massey Ferguson, went to the same corporate office I did in New York. I was not working for him there, but we were in adjoining offices. I took the job with a guy that was actually revitalizing American Standard's internal organization from all of the materials management and procurement standpoint. And then that's the area that I was interested in.
And you were there for how long?
I was only there for a little over a year. And my boss, who I became really enamored with, left and went to work for Mack Trucks in, of all places, Hagerstown, Maryland. And he came in and said, I need one of you to come with me to Mack Trucks. So I went to work for Mack Trucks.
And you stayed with Mack Trucks? Or?
I was there about the same length of time, I think. Probably 5, 6, 7 years, I think. Until we were in negotiations with Chrysler Motor Car Company, principally with the Dodge division. Heavy truck people were interested in acquiring Mack Trucks, or Mack Trucks, that part of Chrysler. And I stayed with them until the thinking that if that did come about, that there would be a good chance of maybe getting back to the Detroit area with Chrysler, or part of that division. But a district judge, a federal judge in the Newark district, went in and said, your negotiations have to cease, you're going to be in trouble with the Robinson-Pettman Act and some other things, and so the negotiations stopped. And at that point, I decided I was going to look to move from get out of the Hagerstown, Maryland area and go somewhere else. So that's when I moved out of there.
And you went from Hagerstown to where?
I went to Franklin, Pennsylvania, which was, I took the vice president of procurement's job with Joy Manufacturing, who built underground mining equipment. Oh. Biggest in the world for underground mining equipment. The machinery division.
How do you spell that company?
Is it J-O-Y. J-O-Y.
Okay.
J-O-Y. They're, it's now called Joy Global. Their headquarters are out of Pittsburgh now. They've moved. But the division I was with was in Franklin, Pennsylvania. Next door to Oil City, if you remember Oil yes. City, where the first oil well was discovered, mm-hmm. the Drake well. And
did you stay with them for the rest of your career?
Or? No. I got together with some folks from an adjoining company called Chicago Pneumatic Tool Company. And they were all neighbors of mine, and we had some joint business associations, but a lot of local social. And they decided they were going to form another company, and did. They came down here. And once they got their feet on the ground, got incorporated, and we came down to visit. And while I was down here visiting, they talked me into joining them. And that's how I got to Florida.
What year was that?
1973.
Yeah. And you stayed with them until you retired?
Until, well, we retired because we sold the company. I had to sell my interest. And
who did you sell to?
We sold to a Finnish holding company, who had a distribution network that sold our kind of equipment. And it's changed hands now 3 times since. It's now owned by a Swedish company called Sandvik.
Oh, sure.
You know Sandvik? The yes. largest cement carbide manufacturer in the world.
Is there anything remaining of the company here in Gainesville?
Oh, yeah, they've got 300 people employed out there. Oh, yeah. They're going pretty well, matter of fact. Mm-hmm. I was out there a week or two ago, and they're completely reorganized. They're doing very little in the same kind of machinery manufacture that we were doing. Their business has changed some. They're into percussion drilling now, where Their market is for road building. Not so much for the coal industry or gold or salt anymore. So, but their worldwide distribution is still good. They're selling a lot of machinery.
What are they called now?
They're called Sandvik.
Oh, they're called Sandvik, okay. Mm-hmm.
Drill-Tec sign is gone and it says Sandvik.
Okay.
So, they still have a couple of our first pieces of equipment are sitting outside there as antiques.
Mm-hmm.
That represent what the start of the business was all about.
When did they change the name from Drill-Tec? Was that recent?
Well, you know, I can't tell you exactly, but I think that on their letterheads and on their corporate, it probably happened a lot faster than the outdoor sign that went up.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't remember seeing a Sandvik sign out there before, say, 2 years ago.
Right.
That was about the last
right.
I remembered.
I remember the Drill-Tec sign.
Drill-Tec sign was out, but I think they were operating under the, they were, their corporate was Scandinavian and was Sandvik.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure their officers were all Swedes.
And when did you and Anne Marie meet?
About 1993 or 94,
okay.
93.
And your first wife died?
She died in 1991.
So you were in Gainesville at that point?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the children, your four children, did they grow up in Gainesville?
Two of them did.
Okay.
My oldest daughter was in college at Cornell.
Okay.
My other three were here and graduated from Gainesville High School.
And so Gainesville was home for them, at
for
least.
Them, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They were, my middle daughter was born in Detroit. The other two were born in Hagerstown, but they grew up literally
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
They went to grade school. Well, my one daughter was 11th grader in high school. But the other two were in grade school and in middle school. So this is their home, essentially.
Now, did you, at any point during that period, did you go back to Europe with them or your wife to revisit where you were stationed?
I went back at least three times. One time, specifically to visit on the continent the major spots that we bombed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we went over and rented a car and traveled around and went back to the air base that I was based at over there after the war. That was actually the headquarters of what was called the Occupational Air Force. For a short time, I don't know how the official name came on it, but
and where was that base?
Called Giebelstadt. It was right outside Wiesbaden.
Okay, right outside of Wiesbaden.
About 12 kilometers to mm-hmm. the southwest of Wiesbaden. No, I'm sorry, not Wiesbaden. Würzburg.
Oh, Würzburg.
Würzburg.
Yeah.
It was the training ground for the German Air Force. It was like our West Point of the Air, where they trained the ME-262, 263 pilots, the rocket fighter planes and stuff. That's where they were trained. And of course, that was one of our last bombing missions, to bomb that airfield.
Mm.
We knew that's where those fighter planes were coming up from. So.
And you went back, you've been back to Honiton and to Snedden?
Well, I went back to Snedden Heath.
Snedden.
The little town of Atterbury, and we went to Norwich, and of course we went to other spots in the UK. Matter of fact, I've been back there a number of times.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me...
We bicycled in Scotland. We took couple of months, and we bicycled from Edinburgh eastbound. We went to Olive Skye. We went to up as far as Udaipur, where the Russian or the sub-10s were. We went probably 500 miles on the bikes and did that in about a 10-day period, along with traveling down below to see some of the spots.
Mm-hmm. So we're in... How do you look back on this World War II experience in the context of your life? Was it the most meaningful, or how do you view it?
It was very meaningful. At the age I was, and a actual outside of the war itself, which was devastating. It was an eye-opening experience as far as travel is concerned. It was an eye-opener as far as experiencing the ravages of war in the British, the British suffered severely, which up until that point we had really not, we weren't actually acquainted with it, but they had some horrible experiences there. The German bombing of London and adjoining areas and so forth, people that experienced that, and we got a chance to be exposed to some of the aftermath of it, was quite an experience to see what those people stood up to. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Churchill was, of course, one of our favorites. And he is a staunch, being part American, he was a favorite. But it was an eye-opener. Mm-hmm. And it did give us a chance to travel over there. I was fortunate because staying over, at the time, it had some unpleasant things because we wanted to get home, but gave us a chance to travel. I saw a part of the world that I would have been a long time in getting to if that hadn't been set up.
Did you talk to, when you visited some of the places you bombed, did you talk to any of the people?
Yes. My last recollection of a conversation doing that was a young fella at Giebelstadt. When we pulled in there, at the time we visited, the things had really changed. The geometry had changed of that airfield. It was fenced in, but there was a huge building there, similar to a Butler building, but a double size, and it was a Volkswagen dealership. And it was right on the edge of the airbase, and I stopped. And this guy came out, and he was probably, at the time we were there, he probably might have been 40 years old. But I asked him, how long he had been there. He was a lifelong resident of the area. And I said, well, do you remember this airbase being bombed? Oh, yeah. He remembered there what was going on. He was not in the military, which was strange. He seemed to have all his faculties, but...
What year was this when you were visiting?
Do you this remember? Was probably... It was probably in the 80s, early 80s, 80, 81, if I remember.
So he'd have been too young to obviously be in the war itself.
It could have been. Yeah. That's right.
He's only 40-something years old?
I'm guessing, but yeah. I figured he was connected with the distributorship for the Volkswagen dealership that was there. I think it was a dealership, but also a garage, a VW garage. Mm-hmm. And but he remembered, he was old enough to remember it being bombed. You
know. It must have been quite extraordinary to go back to these places that were devastated and then to see them rebuilt and people living their lives and their economies doing pretty well.
Yep. The Germans seemed to recover reasonably well. They were pretty industrious, and they put the pieces back together, and it appeared, even though we were the victors in that war, they were fairly friendly to us. There wasn't any great animosity. There was a lot of that right after the end of the hostilities. We had a lot of SS women who were serving us in the officers' club in the base that we were stationed at, and they were still pretty hostile. They were doing what they were told to do, but they were they were not willing participants to.
Mm-hmm.
But by the late 70s and early 80s, they had really done a fair amount of recovery.
And how were they when you chatted with them about your war experience? Were they pretty friendly to talk with you about it, or did they want to just forget it?
They kind of wanted to forget it. Yeah, they were. They didn't want to talk about that. They wanted to. Matter of fact, when we talked to some of what you'd call people on the street when we were there, to some whose age was such that I knew they were involved with the war, they really didn't want to talk about it. They were kind of embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, it was not a very good thing to think about Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany, is it?
Well, yeah. Well. No, they did not want to talk about that. You mentioned their concentration camps or something. Of course, they didn't know about those things. In some ways, I believe this is probably true. They didn't. It was pretty well. Although anybody that was in the vicinity of where these people were being herded to had to know something was going on.
Mm-hmm.
They chose to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
as they chose to ignore some of the other worst aspects of Hitler and Nazism.
That's right. I can't remember really getting into any serious or deep discussions with people on our travels over there.
Tell me what
I've met some over here that have traveled back over here that would have been the age when this was going on, and of course they, their great fear over there were the Russians, not the Americans. The Russian groups particularly that were coming from the Ukraine and the Turks and the Romanians. The Romanians were real disciplinarians, and they really, the Germans were very fearful of them because of the way they treated the civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
They said, the Ruskies are coming. If you wanted to get their attention, you told them the Ruskies were coming in, behave. That quieted things down.
Mm-hmm.
They were not that fearful of the Americans. They're from the same standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Although the American...
We went in, this was in late May. I think it was late May, pretty sure. We went into to Linz, I'm pretty sure it was near Linz, Austria, to bring back prisoners. We flew in, and the Russians had already taken that area over, but we were cleared to go in and get these, but we brought back 22 French prisoners from that POW camp that had been captured near Metz in 1942. They'd been in POW camps. These were all French. 10 of the 22 I brought back were officers. They all survived that time period, including they must have been marched for miles at different times where they moved camps. Not speaking French, I couldn't really converse, but the one captain did, and I had him actually stand up between myself and my co-pilot and flying back. I said, "Where were you captured?" And he told me, and I said, "Okay." And I flew back over where he was captured, and he said he recognized from the air, we were maybe 1,000 feet, he recognized the area where they were captured. He said that was in 1942. And
how had they been treated, had he described?
I couldn't really converse with them, but his experience that I could, and he spoke a little English. He understood us. And we asked him questions principally, and he said it was inhumane, I guess is the word that he used. Mm-hmm. Inhumane, how they treated the prisoners. They were not humanely treated. We flew them all back to Lyon, France, and dropped them off, got the keys to the city, which I have somewhere. From Lyon. We were heroes. Bringing these.
Sure.
22, and of course the rest of our squadron were bringing as many as they could carry back. They wanted to, well, that was our first experience with the Russian troops that were in there. They came out, they wanted, it was amazing, they had confiscated automobiles. These guys were wristwatches from arms, any kind of civilian jewelry, arms. They wanted our airplane. Seriously. I was surprised that they were letting these prisoners go. They had that pretty well organized, but these guys were wild. I was concerned, you know. I didn't want to leave my airplane there.
Mm-hmm. Well, they probably knew how devastated their country was by the Germans.
Yeah,
So they were going to get everything they could to take back.
Boy, they did. I tell you, we saw signs of that, and they were ruthless.
Yeah.
And of course, I had mixed feelings about some of it. The Germans had it coming, but. You don't really treat your enemy that way in civil, in our kind of civilization.
Yeah.
You don't treat the prisoners that way. You don't shoot them if they've surrendered.
Yeah. Although you never know, if we'd been Russian, invaded by the Germans, and our country and our people devastated, we may have been the same way.
That's right.
It's hard to say.
It is. That's right. That's right.
We're very fortunate to be insulated by two oceans.
This is true. But going back, to answer your question, yeah, we did. I traveled from we rented a car in Frankfurt, I remember. And then I traveled from Frankfurt by car. I rode and got along pretty well over there. I spoke very little German, but there's not any trouble over there to find someone that spoke English, school kids particularly. I got lost one place down there where we had reservations to go, into what was like a bread and breakfast spot, and it was off the beaten path, no signs, and I had a picture of it. I went to the schoolyard, and I asked the kids, and at first I said, "Do you speak English?" "Oh yeah, we spoke English, but not very good." I said, "Well, good enough. Do you know where this place is?" "Oh, yeah, we know where that is." And to them, try to explain to me my landmarks, how to find this, which was pretty good. We found it. I thought in the future, I'd just go to the schoolyard. These kids all spoke, they all spoke English.
Well, Bruce, before we wrap this up, any last thoughts or comments you want to make?
No, I don't know. Have you gotten enough from me to...
I think we've gotten... this has been very, very helpful.
Of course, those of us in the same type of military occupation that I was in there are getting fewer and fewer as the time goes by. There are a few of them around town here yet, but I mean, they're thinning out. They built some 12,655 B-17s during the war, and there are only four that are flying today. There's 12 in existence, but only four flyable. And how long they're going to keep those going, I don't know. They're all with the Collins Federal Foundation, who are flying them around to keep the population, I guess, aware of what occurred or what some of these people should be thankful we did what we did do at that time. So hopefully to do the same thing for the Korean vets and the Vietnam has kind of been soft-pedaled because of the unfavorable Vietnamese flavor for the war. But
comments about what you did with the 8th Air Force Museum? What role you played in that?
Well, basically, most of it was... I did a little fact gathering for them, if I remember. And of course I was stirred up visitation when they opened the museum. And supplied information to them, which is on record there. But that was about it.
Mm-hmm. I've been twice to it. It's a really an impressive museum.
It's pretty impressive. Yeah, for the 8th Air Force part of it, it's quite impressive. Well, I think actually from the air museums that I have visited, not just 8th Air Force, but all the Wright-Patterson and Dulles, they've done a pretty good job from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bruce, thank you.
I think it's a good thing that people have the facts about what the 8th Air Force did. Mm-hmm. It was quite significant in our history.
It's quite a story.
It is. If you go on, really digest all of what went on, there's a lot of hardships and a lot of our casualty losses, too, were extremely high for what was attempted to be done. Mm-hmm. And they did accomplish it. A lot of logistics, some of it almost insurmountable. In today's technology world, people look back and said, "What was the problem?" You know, and I said, "Yeah, well, just think back at some of the times you didn't have the things that you got today. You didn't have navigation devices that tell you where you are within centimeters, and you didn't have communications that you have today and what they developed. If you think back, for example, the British and radar, and the Germans actually developed the radar, which was picked up by the British. That was quite phenomenal. And of course, in training over here, we didn't even know that existed until we got over to UK. Find out here, they've got a means of navigation. Whether you're above the clouds or not, you don't need to see the ground anymore. You can tell exactly where you're at.
Well, Bruce, let me just thank you for your time, for sharing your story with me, thank you for your service to this country.
I hope you can put that together to make some sense.
Oh, we can do that quite easily, believe me.